More bodies recovered in Surfside, Florida, as crews race to beat conditions from the approaching tropical storm Elsa. The question is, how will the weather affect the ongoing search? Plus, concern over just how far U.S. vaccination rates have fallen. The question is, what will the president say when he makes another pitch today for Americans to get vaccinated? And today marks 6 months since the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The question is, how is law enforcement doing when it comes to bringing those involved to justice? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that will never forget what happened on January 6th. I am Casey Hunt on this Tuesday, July 6th. We'll start with the news. Search and rescue efforts expanded significantly in Surfside, California on Monday after officials knocked down the rest of the partially collapsed condo.
We're able to report that the search and rescue team has been able to search all sections of the grid on the collapse following the building demolition. Now that the entire area is safe to search. And so the teams have now removed over 4.8 million pounds of concrete from the pile.
Four more bodies were found, raising the number of those killed to 28. 117 people remain unaccounted for nearly 2 weeks after half of the Champlain Towers South condo collapsed in the middle of the night. Search efforts were hampered throughout the day as thunderstorms and strong winds hit the area, thanks to Tropical Storm Elsa continuing to approach the state. Joining us now from Surfside, MSNBC correspondent Vaughn Hilliard. Vaughn, good morning. Thank you for being with us so early. I know you're putting in really long days down there. And while we know Elsa's likely to basically miss Surfside, it still is really impacting the search efforts. What's the latest there and what's the impact?
Yeah, good morning, Casey. You could even see just yesterday afternoon the impacts of the outer bands of Tropical Storm Elsa. It was about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon when the clouds came overhead and wind gusts picked up here and then downpour, torrential rain. It has stopped here at this early hour this morning, but we're expecting with that forecast that the rain to begin coming down here within this next hour and to sustain well into the future here over here these coming days. But when you look at that video, you can see what these crews were up against. The threshold that they are working off is about 30 mile per hour wind gusts that would lead them to pause their rescue mission. That took place, to our understanding, yesterday afternoon, evening, at least two times. This is an effort that is now at 100% capacity. They now have full access to every part of the grid of those buildings, both of those buildings, that the one that collapsed and the one that was demolished here. You said that number is now up to 28 deceased, 117 unaccounted for. The big question is, to what extent is this weather over the course of these next 24, 48 hours, to what extent are they hampered here? The other weather condition that could impact this would be lightning, thunderstorms. We saw that in the initial days after the collapse when there were multiple thunderstorms that rolled in. Crews had to stop for periods of time. And that is the big concern here over these next 2 days as the crews continue this rescue mission.
So, Vaughn, what's their estimate of how quickly they'll be able to find the rest of those people who are missing, or at the very least be able to say they think they've done the best they can?
Casey, what we have heard from officials, that is the best that we can relate to the public here, is that they have said that they are now able to operate in an accelerated rate. Because the big concern, especially one part of the building there that they said that they had previously not been able to access because it was helping hold up that existing structure. But they said they are now able to access all of those areas. They are more able to effectively tunnel underneath the rubble sites because there was concern when they were doing that drilling initially that they were disrupting the very rubble that was helping holding up that existing building. There is no timeline other than one that it's going to take a long time. Again, 28 have been recovered. 117 remain to be accounted for. This is going to be a long haul. Officials continue to insist. They are also, though, still calling this a rescue effort. They say they are not going to be the ones to essentially extinguish that hope for family members that are still hoping to find their loved ones. It is 13 days, though, after that collapse now, Casey.
Such a difficult time still in front of families who are already hurting so much. MSNBC's Vaughn Hilliard, thank you very much for being with us. As we mentioned, Tropical Storm Elsa is churning over Florida, and as of early this morning, the storm hit the Florida Straits. Forecasters expect the Florida Keys to be next in line before the storm turns inland toward the Gulf Coast tomorrow. Elsa pummeled Cuba with strong rain and 50-mile-per-hour winds on Monday. The storm has claimed three lives after hitting the Caribbean islands over the weekend. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns for a check on the forecast there. Bill, this pretty early in the season, but here we are. What's the latest on Elsa?
Elsa is going to be affecting the Florida Peninsula, especially the West Coast, Casey, over the next 24 to 36 hours. It has a slight chance of becoming a hurricane once again. And the path that it's going to take is kind of almost like a worst case scenario for the Florida West Coast with storm surge. Now, this isn't a huge hurricane, so we're not talking about devastation, but even for a tropical storm, it's going to have some significant impact. So let's get you the latest. Just got the new information in from the National Hurricane Center. We still have tropical storm warnings that go all the way up the West Coast of Florida from the Keys, Naples, Fort Myers, Sarasota, the Tampa Bay area, all the way back up towards Cedar Key. And the new information from the Hurricane Center, they have it at 60-mile-per-hour winds. So that's the maximum sustained winds you'd expect with the strongest thunderstorms or the heaviest rain squalls. You notice that Miami has had a couple showers, not much. There's not much going on in West Palm Beach. This is a small storm. This is not a huge storm, so the rain shield will not even affect all of the Florida Peninsula. There will be rain squalls, but as far as the tropical storm rains go, that's over Key West. That'll move up this morning over the Everglades and eventually towards Fort Myers, and then this afternoon and this evening towards Tampa. So here's the new forecast path from the Hurricane Center. Notice that center line goes pretty much parallel to the west coast of Florida. That will allow the water to pile up in the bays all on the west coast, everywhere from about Cedar Key southwards. So that's why the storm surge is the biggest concern right now for the west coast of Florida. Even winds at 70 miles per hour, minimal damage in Florida. Obviously, they're very storm tested over the last couple years and decades. Everything's built to withstand winds like that, but it's still the water surge that you worry about. And then eventually this storm will go all the way up through the Carolinas, right along the southeast coast, coming off the mid-Atlantic coast by the time we get to Thursday night and Friday. So there'll be some squally weather all the way up the eastern seaboard over the next couple days. But the biggest concern of the next 24 to 36 hours is that storm surge. We'll watch that water piling up this morning. Areas of the Keys, not horrible, 1 to 3 feet, you won't see any damage from that, and then 2 to 4 feet this afternoon, this evening, heading up towards Naples, and then tonight and tomorrow morning, that's when we expect, if we're going to get any damage from water, it would be that 3 to 5 foot of water that's possible. And high tide in Florida only is about an additional 1 foot, so that's not going to cause too much additional problems. Peak winds, as I mentioned, we're not expecting a lot of huge issues with the winds. You know, possibility of 40, 50, 60 mile per hour winds. You'll see some things like gas station awnings and some small, you know, stuff like that. Obviously, if you don't bring your stuff inside, some lawn furniture and stuff like that could blow around, and that'll be the worst of it. The other thing we want to mention, we do have heat advisories up for about 29 million people in the Northeast, and we will see some pretty strong thunderstorms in Florida today with the squalls coming through and also into the Northeast. So we'll keep that in mind, Casey, for all our people and friends traveling through the airport. So as far as Elsa goes, you know, it's not going to be a devastating storm by any means, but these storms like this can be sneaky, and we just want everyone to be safe.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Bill, and everyone be careful out there. Thanks very much, Bill Cairns. All right, let's go now to the coronavirus. After falling short of his July 4th vaccination goal, President Biden will deliver remarks this afternoon on the U.S. response to get COVID under control and to push more Americans to get vaccinated. Figures published by the CDC show that the U.S. is currently averaging less than 300,000 first doses daily. Compare that to April, when more than 2 million first doses were being administered every day. Right now, about 67% of U.S. adults have received at least one shot, and the Biden administration is working to boost that number. NBC News White House correspondent Kelly O'Donnell has more.
We're going to double down on our efforts to vaccinate millions of more Americans across July and August.
Four states lag the nation with less than 40% taking even one dose of vaccine. Mississippi ranks last. Denise Taylor, who coached college basketball and in the WNBA, is trying to change that.
I am coaching. I'm just coaching on a different court.
Taylor is going one-on-one each day to make her pitch relatable.
What I found is I put myself in their shoes, and then I let them know, you know what? I was hesitant too.
Among those not yet vaccinated around the country, some say they will not be persuaded.
I told them that I'll take my vaccine on the way to the cemetery in about 15 or 20 years.
As the president and first lady promote vaccines as safe, free, and readily available, the White House touts progress, while still short of its own goal of 70% of adults with at least one shot.
All right, our thanks to NBC's Kelly O'Donnell for that report. Meanwhile, as the Delta variant continues to surge in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced yesterday that England is on course to soon lift most COVID-19 restrictions that require face masks and social distancing. Johnson outlined the final steps in easing of England's lockdown rules, although he acknowledged that lifting the restrictions are going to drive surging coronavirus cases even higher. Meanwhile, public health officials and scientists have urged caution, saying that ditching masks and social distancing altogether could be dangerous. Johnson said a final decision would come on July 12th. Also in the UK, the Duchess of Cambridge is self-isolating after coming into contact with an individual who's tested positive for COVID-19. A spokesperson for Kensington Palace said that Kate, who has been fully vaccinated, is not experiencing any symptoms, but is following government guidelines by self-isolating at home for 10 days. Last week, the Duchess attended both Wimbledon and a Euro 2020 soccer match in London and was tested before each one. The palace did not disclose where she may have been exposed to the virus. Closer to home, after nearly 16 months of closure, pandemic travel restrictions between Canada and the U.S. began to loosen yesterday. Now, Canadian citizens and permanent residents who've had a full dose of a coronavirus vaccine can skip a 14-day quarantine. Eligible air travelers also no longer have to spend their first 3 days in the country at a government-approved hotel. Restrictions barring all non-essential trips between Canada and the United States, including tourism, will remain in place until at least July 21st. All right, coming up here, across the country, campaigns are gearing up for the 2022 midterms, but Republican candidates are increasingly focused on the last election. We will explain that ahead. Plus, it's been 6 months since the January 6th Capitol insurrection, and the Justice Department is still searching for rioters who were involved in the attack. We're going to have those stories and much more when we come right back.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download. It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
And now Anderson from Montreal. There's the puck ahead. Has Caulfield coming for the net. Caulfield off his step. And then Anderson scores!
Tampa Bay can put away the broom. Montreal avoids a Stanley Cup sweep with a 3-2 victory in Game 4 last night, thanks to a pair of goals scored by Josh Anderson, including that overtime winner. The best-of-seven series now shifts back to Tampa for Game 5 tomorrow night. Meanwhile, we're learning more about what authorities described yesterday as a tragic accident at a Michigan home on the 4th of July that claimed the life of Columbus Blue Jackets goaltender Matisse Kalinic. An autopsy has revealed that the 24-year-old died of chest trauma from an errant fireworks mortar blast. Police say the firework tilted slightly and started to fire toward people on Sunday night. Kalinic was in a nearby hot tub and tried to get clear along with several others when he was struck. Responders took about 5 minutes to arrive at the scene after receiving a 911 call. Kalinic was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Prior to the autopsy, police said Kalinic was believed to have slipped and hit his head on concrete while running from the errant mortar. A moment of silence was held in his memory prior to last night's game. So sad. All right, let's turn now to the final Manic Monday at the All England Club. The last time we'll see all 16 women's and men's fourth round singles matches scheduled on the same day. Eight-time champ Roger Federer coming off a pair of knee operations last season and playing in his last Grand Slam tournament before turning 40 is now the oldest Wimbledon quarterfinalist in the Open era, as yesterday's straight set victory moves Federer into his record-extending 18th quarterfinal at the tournament. Meanwhile, world number one Novak Djokovic also advances, winning in straight sets to make it to his 12th quarterfinal at the All England Club while continuing his pursuit of a calendar year Grand Slam. Djokovic needs to win three more matches this week to equal the men's record of 20 major singles titles currently shared by Federer and Rafael Nadal. Over on the women's side, 17-year-old American Coco Gauff's Wimbledon run has ended in the fourth round again. She fell in straight sets against 2018 champ Angelique Kerber. All right, going now to Major League Baseball, where a day after Shohei Ohtani made history by becoming the first player to be selected to the All-Star Game as both a position player and a pitcher, wow, Angels manager Joe Maddon confirmed yesterday that Ohtani will both hit and pitch in next week's game at Colorado's Coors Field. The only remaining questions are about the logistics of Ohtani's appearance at the Midsummer Classic and whether the Major League home run leader will start on the mound for the American League, which would allow him to contribute both ways immediately as the pitcher and the designated hitter. Wow. And finally, in Miami, Dodgers slugger Albert Pujols adds another accolade to his Hall of Fame resume. With a single line to center field in eighth innings. In the eighth inning, Pujols now just the fourth player in Major League history to reach 6,000 career total bases, joining greats Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, and Willie Mays. But it's not enough to put L.A. past the Marlins, which ended the Dodgers' nine-game winning streak with a 5-4 victory last night. All right, still ahead here, we are learning new details about what cybersecurity experts are calling the single biggest global ransomware attack on record, including a new multi-million dollar demand from the hackers. We're back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Welcome back. The Vatican announced yesterday that Pope Francis was, quote, in good overall condition and breathing on his own, a day after the pontiff underwent a three-hour surgery to remove half of his colon. While the Vatican announced on Sunday afternoon that Francis had been admitted to the hospital, it said the operation had been planned in advance. The Associated Press reports the Pope needed the procedure because of a narrowing of a portion of his large intestines that doctors say can be quite painful. Pope Francis is expected to be in the hospital for about 7 days. And now this, Our Evil, the Russian language group behind the latest ransomware attack, is now demanding $70 million to unlock the thousands of businesses affected by the hack. The hacking group, best known for extorting $11 million from the meat processor JBS, posted the demand on a dark website associated with the group. It wants the funds in Bitcoin and said if it receives the money, it will publish a decryptor key to unlock the victim's files. Kaseya, a Miami-based IT firm that helps businesses manage their computer systems, was the target of the attack. President Biden said over the weekend the U.S. would respond if it was determined that the Kremlin is at all involved in the attack. And across the country, many Americans who served as medics in the military are struggling to find work in the medical field as civilians. NBC News correspondent Aaron Gilchrist has more on why and what's being done to change it.
As an enlisted sailor, Eric Dodson spent 11 years in the U.S. Navy trained as a hospital corpsman, working on the front lines, assisting with surgeries and mass casualty incidents.
And it was, hey, we have like 20 people coming in, take care of some, like find someone to take care of them.
After his military service, Dodson volunteered as a registered nurse at a COVID field hospital in New York.
Once that was over, because the mission had finished, I was applying for jobs as an ER tech and being told I wasn't qualified.
Did anyone ask about your work experience, your life experience?
A lot of it was very much, hey, this is an impressive resume. We love this. We'd love to have you, but, you know, you just don't have the right certifications.
Dodson's problem is not unique.
At a time of great need, for healthcare workers, we're turning away some of the nation's most qualified, experienced healthcare workers.
According to the Call of Duty Endowment, only a handful of states have clear pathways from military healthcare to civilian healthcare jobs.
And you're confronted with these bewildering regulations. And sometimes a lot of these folks just give up and they find other careers, which is a real shame.
The military has found a way to address this problem. Now all enlisted medical personnel come to one place where they learn, they train, and then they're able to take those skills and certifications into the civilian world.
Colonel Richard Villarreal is the Dean of Academics at the Defense Department's Medical Training Campus.
Tactical field care, let's go!
Over time, we've realized that it's better if we can provide each individual soldier, sailor, and airman with something that they can take out to the civilian community once they have finished serving their country in the military.
The military now provides these certificates and even college credits that transfer into the civilian world, too.
They at least have a pathway using one of these bridge programs.
The military shifting to help veterans help more people here at home.
Our thanks to NBC's Aaron Gilchrist for that report. All right, still ahead here, the latest on infrastructure negotiations. Yes, they are still going on, including new informal discussions between the White House and conservative policy experts about a possible second bipartisan package. But before we go to break, we want to know, as always, why are you awake? Email us your reasons for being up and watching the Way Too Early at MSNBC.com, or drop me a tweet at Casey, use the hashtag Way Too Early, and we'll read some of our favorite answers coming up later on in the show. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It is 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Casey Hunt. Republicans across the country are preparing for the upcoming midterm elections by focusing on the last election. GOP candidates are endorsing the big lie that former President Trump really won the presidential election as a central part of a message for their campaigns. The Washington Post reports that of the nearly 700 Republicans who filed initial paperwork with the Federal Election Commission to run next year for either the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives, at least one-third have embraced Trump's false claims about his defeat. Of those Republicans, more than 130 are sitting lawmakers who voted not to certify President Biden's election win on January 6th. Elected officials who spoke out against the conspiracy theory, like Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, have become key targets for primary challengers. And today marks 6 months since that devastating attack on the U.S. Capitol. And while more than 500 people have been arrested, the FBI is still working to identify hundreds more, including whomever is responsible for placing pipe bombs outside the offices of both the Republican and Democratic National Committees. As the AP points out, officials made few arrests on the day of the riot because they were focused on clearing the Capitol and protecting lawmakers. However, officials have gotten some help from amateur detectives using crowdsourcing methods to help identify rioters. More than two dozen defendants have pleaded guilty so far. One woman has been sentenced, though she avoided jail time. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports the Biden administration is revamping the way the U.S. uses punitive economic sanctions, according to people involved in the planning process. The White House has foreshadowed elements of the new strategy with the planned easing of economy-wide sanctions against Iran. Administration officials maintain that the use of sanctions must be part of larger diplomatic efforts involving cooperation from allies and related forms of persuasion to bring about foreign policy goals. According to the Journal, the White House wants to collaborate with allies on sanctions against China for human rights abuses and Russia for attacks on political opponents. Former Trump administration officials are concerned that relying on international consensus and waiting for allies often require policy compromises that can undermine national security. Okay. Joining us now, White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of the playbook, Eugene Daniels. He is also an MSNBC contributor. Eugene, it's great to have you here in person. Thank you for getting up so early. And actually, we have to wear real clothes in the studio.
On.
It's a whole new thing. We got to get used to it again. But let's talk for a second about these Republican messages, because you obviously have started to see it in places where there's especially candidates who are concerned about what the former president is going to do. They want his endorsement in these races. But the effect is that this is continuing to be disseminated, repeated over and over and over again in a way that frankly, just divides us further.
Yeah, and I mean, it's in those federal races, but it's also in the local races, in those state races, too, where they're having to repeat these lies by former President Trump. And what you hear, what's really interesting, is he's promised to be kind of mucking it up in the primary over and over, picking candidates that will spread these lies, all of that good stuff. But Tom Emmer, who heads up the House Republican arm of the campaign arm for the House Republicans, has already told us at Playbook months ago that he wouldn't find that helpful. So I would assume that he would also not find helpful the spreading of that exact same lie over and over. And they're worried about that, right? There are Republicans. You talk to a lot of Republicans on the Hill who are worried about what this does to the country when you're spreading these lies just to win something, right? And some of them that are spreading it don't even believe it.
Well, and some of this is about money, right? I mean, they want to fundraise. This seems to be something that generates small dollar donations from the base. We saw how much money former President Trump raised, but how much damage does it potentially do? I mean, we talk often about who's going to take the House in 2022 as, I don't want to say a foregone conclusion, but history would say that Republicans are likely to pick up seats, add redistricting. Mm-hmm. On top of that, it's a tough road for Democrats. But do you think Republicans sacrifice with the few swing voters that are left still have a significant impact in something like this, especially in these suburban districts? Is there any concern that this messaging alienates them?
No, absolutely. Especially in, like you said, in those suburban districts, you get a Trumpy, a Marjorie Taylor Greene person in the primary. But then when they get to the general, if Democrats just get enough people to the ballot box, they're going to probably vote against that Marjorie Taylor Greene character. And that is something that you talk to Republicans that work on the campaign side that they are a little bit concerned about. They've talked to us about it. They won't say it in front of cameras just yet, but they are worried about it because they know that those suburban districts are still key for them as they're kind of, there's some realignment happening with those voters right now.
Yeah. So, Eugene, let's talk for a second. We had that story about the Biden administration's approach to sanctions, and it's an interesting strategy to shift. Republicans, I mean, I can already hear them seizing on this and saying, you know, this is just another example of the president's weakness. What's the White House's thinking on this change?
Yeah, one of the things that this White House has talked about over and over is that America is back, right? And what they mean by that is changing the way that we use carrots and sticks also, right? Going and working on these multilateral agreements. And that is what they're looking at to do instead of just going to do sanctions on their own, right? And that is something that in the White House, they have always believed, and Joe Biden believed that he was in, you know, he was the foreign policy guy for the 8 years of the Obama administration and the 36 years when he was in Congress. And so that is how they view it, because what they want to do is differentiate themselves from the Trump administration as much as they possibly can. And it is a core tenet of this administration that working with allies and figuring out ways to use the diplomatic things before they hit people with those sticks.
Yeah, it's clear that this is an area where the president personally is very involved. Not that he's not personally involved with every decision that his administration makes, but he particularly likes these types of issues. Politico's Eugene Daniels, thank you so much for getting up early and being with us this morning. We really appreciate it. Now there's this story. Afghan military officials are speaking out after the U.S. reportedly left the Bagram airfield last week by shutting off the power and slipping out in the middle of the night. Officials say U.S. troops called them from the airport to tell them that they had left the country's biggest base on Friday after nearly 20 years. Before the Afghan army could take control, the airfield was reportedly ransacked by looters who capitalized when they saw that the power was turned off. According to the Afghan military, U.S. troops left behind thousands of vehicles, but many were missing the keys. They also say the U.S. took the most powerful weapons with them and blew up the ammunition before leaving. One Afghan soldier said in part, quote, in one night, they lost all the goodwill of 20 years. Wow. All right. Still ahead. Baby, We Were Born to Ride. The totally different Springsteen taking the reins as a headliner for Team USA. Way too early. Back in just a moment. Welcome back. Time now for something totally different. The boss's daughter is heading to Tokyo. Jessica Springsteen, daughter of Bruce, has been named as a member of the U.S. Olympic equestrian team. The younger Springsteen was an alternate rider for the 2012 U.S. team in London and didn't qualify for Rio in 2016, now making her Olympic debut as a member of the jumping squad. The 29-year-old began riding horses at 4 years old on her family's farm in New Jersey, and she's now ranked third on the U.S. rider list and 27th in the world. Good luck. Meanwhile, Amazon ushers in a new era as founder Jeff Bezos has officially stepped down as CEO, handing the reins over to Andy Jassy, who previously ran the company's cloud computing business. Bezos, as Amazon's largest shareholder, will take over the role of executive chair, focusing on new projects and initiatives like his space exploration company, Blue Origin. The move comes weeks before the billionaire is set to launch into space on Blue Origin's debut flight alongside his brother. And two four-day workweek trials in Iceland have rendered, quote, overwhelming success. More than 2,500 workers across 100 workplaces took part in two government-backed trials over 4 years, representing roughly 1% of the country's working population. Many had their working hours reduced to 35 from 40 without a reduction in pay. Analysis of the study suggests there was no overall loss of productivity or quality of service provided, and it found that teams were actually encouraged to work more efficiently. There was also an improvement in worker well-being, with perceived levels of stress and burnout falling in many cases. Since completion of the trials, 86% of Iceland's workforce is now working fewer hours or on its way to implementing a shorter work week. All right, still ahead here, the second bipartisan infrastructure package now in the works at the White House. But as we go to break, let's take a look at this date in history. 24 years ago, the rover Sojourner rolled down a ramp from the Mars Pathfinder and onto the Martian landscape to begin inspecting the soil and rocks of the Red Planet.
The rover has already overcome one small hazard. As NASA scientists waited nervously for the rover to leave its home, the lander, and roll to the surface, there was a small rock in the way. Rover went over it with no problem.
There it is.
Welcome back. A second infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure plan, could potentially be in the works. The Washington Examiner reports that senior White House officials are holding, quote, informal discussions with both conservative and liberal policy experts. The separate package could be an offshoot from the Democratic-only reconciliation bill that addresses human infrastructure, including the child tax credit. According to individuals with knowledge of the talks, senior advisors to the president, Gene Sperling and Neera Tanden, as well as a handful of other economic aides, are leading the discussions. Joining us now, the former chief of staff to the DCCC, Adrian Elrod, who is also a senior aide to the Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden presidential campaigns. Adrian, it is so great to see you in person. It's been far too long. Thank you so much for being here. So let's talk about, this is turning quickly into infrastructure year, quite frankly. I mean, they obviously at the beginning got a huge COVID relief package done, and the president has touted that as a major accomplishment. But since then, there have been these ongoing negotiations with Republicans. And I know you spend a lot of time thinking about how this plays out across the political map. And I guess I'm curious, the stopping point for this was supposed to be Memorial Day. People said, okay, we'll talk to Republicans till Memorial Day. We are now past the July 4th holiday. We're still talking about these bipartisan negotiations, and the administration doesn't have much to show for it necessarily. What's the end of the road here for you on these bipartisan talks?
Well, you know, first of all, I think you've got to take a step back and look at Joe Biden's career. He is somebody who's a master of the Senate. He spent 35 plus years in the United States Senate working with Republicans. That was during a time when Democrats and Republicans work together consistently. So he wants this to be a bipartisan bill. It's looking like we're getting closer to just being able to pass it with Democrats, which is kind of disappointing, but that's where we are in the game. I think the big questions for Joe Biden are, number one, how do you keep the moderates and the progressives together on any kind of legislation at this point? And number two, it's going to be very difficult politically for not just Joe Biden, but anybody, frankly, with the fact that paid leave and the care economy, as they call it, child care, et cetera, those are big factors that Democrats and Republicans across the country want. So just passing an infrastructure-only, hard infrastructure-only bill is going to be very challenging for both parties. So I think going forward, how do you actually get this care economy passed? And I think that's something that Democrats and Republicans will both want.
Well, Republicans on the Hill, I would say, have been pretty critical of that, saying this isn't what we're talking about. This is just an excuse to expand all of these social programs. What do you make of this reporting that there's conversations led by Neera Tanden and Ron Klain Gene Sperling, about a second bipartisan package around the care economy? I mean, I get Republicans are into the child tax credit, but I find that a little far-fetched at this point.
Yeah, look, here's the bottom line. You know this, Casey, because you've been covering the Hill for a long time. There's a big difference between what some of the Republicans will support on the Hill versus what their constituents want.
Sure.
You know, paid leave, childcare, that is not a Democrat versus Republican issue. That is something that a lot of Republicans want, too. That is something that the American people want, regardless of their party affiliation. So I think, again, you're seeing Gene and Neera, both seasoned operatives who know the Hill and know the White House, really go to bat and see what they can get done. But I think probably at the end of the day, Casey, very disappointedly, you're going to see this bill pass or something pass that does not have any Republican support.
And you're talking about reconciliation there. I mean, how confident are you that they can get it through the House? I mean, we've talked a lot about the Senate. We've talked a lot about Joe Manchin. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's majority is so narrow. And you referenced the challenges with progressives and moderates. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are already moderate Democrats who are saying, I don't know if I can vote to raise taxes the way this bill likely would.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, Nancy Pelosi's got one of the toughest jobs in Washington, D.C., but she's very good at it. She seems to always pull through. She knows her caucus like nobody else, and she knows the members of her caucus and what makes them tick and what makes it work. So she knows that she's got a very fine balancing act between making sure that the moderates don't leave and, of course, making sure the progressives are happy, too. Climate change, that's going to be an issue that's got to be addressed. And, you know, whatever form, whether that's a larger, broader package or some sort of smaller standalone measure, you're going to lose progressives if climate change is not addressed in some way, shape or form. So she's got a very fine balancing act, but I have all the faith in the world that she's going to figure out how to make this work and how to get this passed.
I remember watching from the gallery when she did it with the Affordable Care Act, which is, of course, it was in that very moment, and she pulled it off. So I'm with you. I will not discount her. Adrienne Allred, thank you so much for coming on this morning to share your insights. We really appreciate it. And earlier on in the show, we asked all of you, why are you awake? Nancy tweeted this, I'm still up here in California because if I go to sleep, when I wake up, my long weekend will be over. Sorry about that. Thank you for staying up way too late with us. Suzanne, who is listening on Sirius XM Radio, says, my husband and I and our two chihuahuas are halfway through our 20-hour drive to Connecticut. Oh, my. We're finally visiting my 88-year-old mother after missing our annual visit because of COVID. She must be thrilled. Thanks for listening. And Joni sent us this photo saying she's awake because of these two little guys. Look at those puppies. Adorable. We love them. Thank you all for being with us today. Coming up next here, we're going to take a look at the Axios One Big Thing. And coming up on Morning Joe, the latest from Surfside, Florida, as we continue tracking the path of Tropical Storm Elsa and its potential impact in the ongoing search for survivors nearly 2 weeks after that devastating condominium collapse. Don't go anywhere. Morning Joe, just moments away.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.